What's happening, everybody? Episode number 36 of the BuckoCast. Josh Taylor here with you. And joining me in the booth while Jason is recuperating, he's kind of on the injured list, if you will, for the time being. So once again, bringing him back. We like to have him pinch hit from time to time. Greg Finley, my colleague from the Sunday Morning Grind on 93.7 The Fan, joins me here on the BuckoCast, episode number 36. Greg, what's happening?
Josh, how are you today?
I'm good. I'm excellent. I'm enjoying a nice little bit of time off here. So it's been 3 days off, then I go back to work for 1 day, and then 3 more days off.
Well, that's fantastic.
So I'm happy. I'm happy. But yeah, Craig Wilson episode of the BuckoCast. You like that pick?
I'm okay with that pick. That's my guy right there.
Yeah, it was between a couple different guys. It was either Craig Wilson, Justin Morneau, or Edinson Volquez. I figured Craig Wilson was the most fitting of the three.
If you're Craig Wilson and you got traded to the Yankees like he did at the deadline, how happy are you for how bad the Pirates were at that time? It's like, oh, I'm going to the Yankees. I might win a World Series.
It's kind of hilarious that we always hear the biggest critique, or at least among some fans, the biggest critique of the Pirates is, oh, they're just a farm team for the Yankees. And of all the guys to be traded from this roster to the Yankees, Craig Wilson is one of those guys. Kind of goes against the whole stereotype, which makes it even more funny because it's so ironic.
Right?
But yeah, I'm pretty sure he was excited to hear that.
Wouldn't you be?
Yeah, he probably was not as excited to hear that he probably wouldn't play a lot because
right.
he was going from the Pirates to the Yankees. So that probably made a lot of a difference, too.
When they had an outfield like Bernie Williams, Gary Sheffield, and Hideki Matsui.
Yeah, they were pretty talented.
Yeah.
They were pretty good.
Imagine that.
I know, right?
It's 2019, and they're still really good at baseball.
Who saw that coming? Right? Well, we'll say this much. As much as we are joking about, you know, certain things, at least in the past, historically, what we're looking at right now is probably not as funny. Because let's put it to you this way, and I have to admit, I found this one particular number interesting, and this is coming from former MLB Executive of the Year, colleague of ours, Greg Jack Zarencic, who's involved with the Pirates pregame and post on the Pirates Baseball Network. He came up with a great number that I thought was just absolutely astounding. At one point this season, the Pirates were 24-20 in the month of May. They've won 24 games since then.
That's not good.
No, that says a lot about this team.
But what's interesting about that is, since the All-Star break, they've only won 4 games.
Yes.
So when they went into the All-Star break only 2.5 out, they still weren't playing that good of baseball.
They had only won 20 games since that point in May, going into the All-Star break.
And what we talked about was how open the National League Central was.
Right.
Because nobody was running away with it at the time.
No one had really stepped head and shoulders above. No one had really separated themselves. And as far as at least the lineups go, you knew what to expect from Chicago. You knew what to expect from Milwaukee. You knew what to expect even from St. Louis, even with the injuries that they had. But in the midst of all of that, the thing that kept sticking out to us is there's no pitching staff that really jumps out at you in this division. None of them seem that, you know, intimidating or that daunting enough that they couldn't be overcome.
And now it's the Reds.
And now it's the Reds. And the Pirates pitching staff has been god awful. If it's not the starting pitching, it's the bullpen. It just seems like it's coming on both sides. The one day you get a good start out of the starter, the bullpen falls apart. Or, you know, the one day the bullpen pitches well, it's too late because the starter's already given up a multiple run lead. It just seems like they can't seem to win for losing when it comes to the pitching aspect of it all.
Archer pitches a great game against the Mets over the weekend. Bullpen couldn't keep it together, and they let Wilson Ramos single-handedly beat them with 6 RBIs in that game.
And he drove in 5 in the last 2 innings.
Exactly.
That says a lot, really. And that's also given the fact that the first start coming out of the break, Chris Archer had that start and pitched well in that one, and the bullpen fell apart in that one. So
it
tells you a lot about just how everything seems to be falling apart on both ends of the pitching staff, whether it be the starting rotation or the bullpen. Then you see a night like Stephen Brault that he had, you know, this recent Tuesday evening, and that ends up going for naught. That ends up going pretty much by the wayside because he couldn't get much run support. And now he goes back to possibly being one of your most consistent starters after one start, missing all that time on the injured list. It's really odd.
Well, yeah. I mean, they scored seven runs against the Brewers on Monday, lost that game because they gave up nine.
Right.
Well, Christian Yelich kind of destroyed them by himself.
Yeah,
but
he happened. Christian yeah. Yelich happened.
He hit one into the river.
The reigning MVP. The reigning MVP acted like the reigning MVP. Funny how that goes down, right?
and then yesterday, or yeah, on Tuesday, they lose 4-3 to the Brewers. Brault was not able to do it for them, but it just seems like every time with this starting rotation, nobody can get them a quality start. Or if they can, the bullpen comes in and completely blows it up.
They can't hold it up.
I mean, you have to ask yourself, when is it time to bring in Vasquez whenever it's not a non-safe situation, but it's a time to possibly win a baseball game? Because him sitting there until the opportunity comes for a save, it's not working.
And it doesn't help in the context of it all when we have gone through a trade deadline that came and won a week ago. And he was one of the most sought-after names on the entire trade market. And you didn't move him for whatever reason. You felt like you didn't get the return you wanted. Okay, fine. So you don't move him, and then you don't use him.
Exactly.
So what's going on here? Because I think he's been used one time since that trade deadline came and went.
Yeah.
So how about that? It seems like a really odd thing to talk about. And we'll get more into that later, because we're going to talk a little bit more about Felipe Vasquez when the time comes. So it does speak to there are so many different things that aren't really lining up with this pitching staff, whether it's the starters being inconsistent or the bullpen being inconsistent or just the lack of usage of Vasquez for that matter, or more importantly, just the failure of one guy to at least step in and stabilize everything. We always talk about, oh, who's the ace of this staff? Who's the ace of this staff? I'm going to say the same thing I've been saying for the last 10 years or so. This staff does not have an ace.
You're right.
It does. You have to earn that title. No one in the past 10 decades, or not 10 decades, the last 10 years, the last decade, and if you want to take it back further, you could probably find it. If you're going back to Doug Drabek, you probably wouldn't be wrong. But who really has been good enough? Who's been consistent enough? Who's been reliable enough since, God, the last almost 30 years to be considered the ace of a pitching staff?
And we haven't seen it at all over the last couple of years. You thought that Tyone was going
to
be the guy.
He was expected
guy. And he kept getting hurt.
But which comes back to my original statement. You have to earn that status. There are a lot of people that felt Gerrit Cole had reached that. And after they felt that, he gave up 30 home runs in one season.
He did not earn it. No.
He hadn't gotten to that point yet. To his credit, you can make the case that he was still developing and still learning as a pitcher. And I
Correct.
Think that's fair.
Yes.
But part of being that guy is that whenever they give you the ball, okay, if you're having a losing streak, he stops it. If you're having a winning streak, he keeps it going. He's that guy that you know. Anytime the rotation goes to return, you're going to have at least a shot to win because of that guy on that night. They have not had that guy in almost 30 years. And I don't think it's safe to really say if they're going to have that guy anytime soon, because let's be honest with ourselves. Even if we are considering Jameson Taillon, who was expected to be that guy, we're not going to see him for a good chunk of next year.
Exactly.
So when does that guy really show up? Does it show up maybe late 2020? Does that guy show up in 2021? Is it too late by then? How do you even anticipate that? Because as good as Mitch Keller's been, are we even looking that far ahead? I don't know if I can. I don't know if we have that kind of benefit right now to look that far ahead, because Mitch Keller is still not here. So there's that whole dynamic. There's just no real guy that can step ahead and say, okay, this is the guy you give the ball to, that we can stop the bleeding here and start everything fresh, start everything anew. They don't have that guy. And that really is what stands out if you want to talk about those 24 games, counting the 25th at the time of the recording that they're playing right now against the Brewers. But those 24 games since the break, they have not had that guy that put a foot down and said, okay, this ends here.
And what they tried to do at last year's trade deadline is bring in Chris Archer to be that guy.
They want him to be that guy.
And he's not. He has not been that guy.
In fairness, he's gotten better, but it's because of an adjustment that he himself decided to make that it was not of the organization's doing. It was of his own volition. He told Jacob Stallings, look, we're scrapping his two-seamer. We're going back to doing this the way I'm used to doing it. And in fairness, he's been better since then. Has he been good enough to be that guy to put the foot down?
No.
Not yet. You see progress, but at this point, progress at this point in the season, you hear a lot about rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic. It probably sounds like that same comparison. But if you're looking for improvement at this point in the season, I'd say it's more like decaf coffee. What the hell's the point? It really doesn't matter at this point anymore.
Right, yeah. I mean, they have dropped so far down from where they were when you went into All-Star break. And we talked about it, what was it, two shows ago?
We did.
When we were on the air, we said the month of July will make or break this team because of how many big games they have coming up. The month of July has killed them.
Yes, it's destroyed them.
They were doing okay going into the All-Star break because they got hot at the right time. Because
they had slumped before then.
Right.
They managed to get hot.
They took 3 of 4 from the Cubs to open up the month of July. They took 2 of 3 from the Brewers, and then they went into the All-Star break. So they were coming into the All-Star break 5-2. They went into Houston, took care of business at the end of June. I mean, it seemed like things were going well for them. And then you come out of the All-Star break, and it's just L after L after L, and it's against teams that you had to beat. In Chicago, lost 2 of 3. In St. Louis, lost 2 of 3. At home against the Cardinals, got swept. Just got swept by the Mets in New York.
You got swept by the Cardinals in 4 games at home before they went to New York.
Exactly. Yep. And you lost 2 of 3 to the Phillies, and then you lost 2 of 3 to the Reds. So the month of July has not been nice to them. Month of August hasn't been much better either. Well, it's already August 7th, and they only have 1 W in their column.
While losing 2 out of 3 to the Mets again.
Yes.
Facing them a second time around after being swept on the road in New York. So it just continues to pile on and pile on. It leads to this question. Because I'm looking at two different things. One, I'm looking at the fact that this pitching staff has been one of the worst in the National League since the All-Star break. That's one thing. The second thing, and I'll put the question out first. Where do you see them going next as far as the next move they have to make, or as far as how do I put this? I'll ask this question. I'll ask it this way. What happens with Ray Searich now?
I have to think that he's in the hot seat. This pitching staff has been a ginormous disappointment.
I would have assumed he was coming into the season on the hot seat.
Yes.
I would have assumed as much.
Yes.
I'm of the belief now that they're going to need a scapegoat when this season's over.
And it's not going to be Clint Hurdle.
It's not going to be Clint Hurdle. It's not going to be Huntington. These guys are in year one of a 3-year contract extension. I don't think those guys are going anywhere. I can't see this organization paying those two guys, both of them, for 2 years to go away. I just don't see it. They're going to need a scapegoat. They already got rid of the hitting coach last year. It kind of makes, you know, the logical thing to move from the hitting coach to the pitching coach. It just seems like Ray Searich is going to be the guy to fall on the sword for this. And I don't think it's necessarily unfair, because here's the thing I look at. A, I look how this staff has fallen apart in the second half of the season, like I just mentioned a moment ago. B, the most significant adjustments we've seen the pitchers on this staff make have been of their own volition. Chris Archer scrapping the two-seamer and going back to just throwing a four-seamer and his other pitches with it, that was of his own volition. Jameson Taillon adopting the slider was of his own volition. Joe Musgrove coming to the realization, hey, when I use my slider more, I tend to pitch better. I think that's of his own volition. We are seeing guys in this pitching staff, in this rotation, make some of their most significant adjustments, and they've really been on their own. Now, Ray Searich will probably tell you, well, these guys are doing the work and they're understanding what they need to do. And he'd probably give the guys the credit. But you have to start asking the question, when do we stop seeing how much of his fingerprints are on this pitching staff and how much of this is their own work?
Right.
And if it is their own work, why is that guy around? Why is he still here? The weird thing is, you have guys like the Gerrit Coles and the Jameson Taillons and the Chris Archers who seem to either figure it out, Charlie Morton, if you want to add to that group, who either seem to figure it out on their own or figure it out somewhere else. Meanwhile, Ray Searich has been useful. He's been useful with the Francisco Lirianos of the world, the A.J. Burnetts, the Edinson Volquezes, and even to a degree Trevor Williams. But what was the difference with those guys? And if you want to make the argument, you can even make the argument for Jay Happ for that short period of time he was here in 2015. But what's the difference with those guys outside of Trevor Williams? All of those guys were over 30. They were in the latter parts of their careers. We're talking about guys that are still relatively on the earlier part or midway part of their careers, and they're still developing or expected to get better. And those guys are the ones he can't seem to hit on. He's hitting on the older guys that have to make more tweaks and probably use a little bit more guile and deception as opposed to the younger guys who have talent and maybe a little bit more in the tank to use, and they're not getting the most out of it.
Yeah, I mean, look at Dick Kingham. And he didn't work out. Tyler Glasnow didn't work out. Charlie Morton, when he was young with this Pirates team, he wasn't able to figure it out, it seemed like. I agree.
But he also admitted, Morton admitted in an interview, I think it was with Jason Mackey of the Post-Gazette, he even said as much. He says, hey, you know, my lack of success with the Pirates was my own fault. I don't blame them. I blame me. So good on him for actually, you know, taking that on himself and say, look, they gave me opportunities. They gave me the contract that I had at the time. They actually had faith in me, and I didn't deliver, so I understood why they traded me. Because people just kind of look at, oh, Charlie Morton went to Houston. Well, no, he stopped in Philly first, and he was bad in Philly.
He was really bad in Philly.
He was bad in Philly, and he got hurt in Philly. A.J. Burnett left Pittsburgh, went to Philly for a year, and he was bad in Philly and then came back. So, you know, we tend to think, though, they just go elsewhere and have success. Charlie Morton did not have it right away, and he will tell you that. He said, you know, things didn't go well in Pittsburgh. I get traded to Philly. Things don't go well in Philly. Then he goes to Houston. Then he changes his workout routine. Then he changes some things and fine-tunes some things with his own game. Now, in fairness, the Astros gave him that kind of leeway to say, look, here's what you do well. Go do what you do well and go out and throw, which is what they've done with a lot of pitchers and probably why they've had success there, including a guy like Aaron Sanchez, who comes from Toronto and goes out and throws a combined no-hitter. They let guys figure out what works for them, and then they just go out and do it. But we have not seen that particular pattern happen with the Pirates, and therein lies a lot of the problem.
Yep, the very young rotation and a struggling Chris Archer from last year. I mean, He wasn't killing it with Tampa Bay.
Not for that year.
When they traded him.
Yeah, that first half of the season had not been that flattering. That's true.
And that's what made me think, okay, new scenery for him. We're going to get the same Archer that dominated when he was with Tampa. Are we seeing signs of it? We saw it whenever he faced off against the Mets in his last outing. He's looked better. But there have also been those outings where it's like, oh boy, Archer's giving up home run after home run, or he can't find the strike zone. So, yeah, Serge said, I think it's his time after this season.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that. I mean, there's a lot of different examples that point to it. Meanwhile, let's shift over. We want to hear from you, our listeners. It's time for the question of the week, and it comes from the BuccoCast and also Jason's Twitter accounts as well. But you can also find it at the BuccoCast. But Jason posted this question earlier in the week. I believe it was on Monday. And the question was, which of the quote-unquote kids will you be watching most intently over the season's final weeks? Is it Brian Reynolds? Is it Cole Tucker if he comes back up? Someone else? Let us know. We got a few different responses here. Gary says it largely depends on who they call up. He's most intrigued by Keller. He'd also like to see Jose Osuna get a good run, which he is now at this point. Maybe Jason Martin. Les on Twitter says he would love to see Cole Tucker come back up and get some turns at shortening the lineup. He also says Reynolds has been killing it as a rookie. Osuna's been looking good during the weekend. Murray says Kevin Newman. He loved him at Arizona, and he's glad he didn't get run out of town when everyone was calling for Newman's head. Mort says Reynolds is a keeper. Tucker needs to hit better before he comes back up. Plus, you have Kevin Newman who's been playing well, so no rush for Tucker. He says the only bad thing is if Reynolds keeps up playing well, he'd be gone in a couple years. Actually, probably a lot further down the road than that. So I'm not even worried about that. You're saying a couple years. It's probably more like 4 or 5. So I don't even think that's an issue right now. I think that's way too early to start looking at that clock. Tanner says Cole Tucker. He says need to shore up the infield and see what they have for next year. Josh also says Tucker because with that hair, I can actually smile at an otherwise rough season. So pretty creative answer there from Josh. But we're hearing a lot of the same names. Tucker, Reynolds, Newman, Osuna. Those are the names we're hearing the most of. We have one that mentioned Mitch Keller, but it's those four guys. But I don't even consider Jose Osuna to be necessarily a kid.
Right.
He's just a guy that's kind of been stuck in limbo because the positions that he plays, he's been stuck behind other guys. Because first base, he's stuck behind Josh Bell. Third base, he was stuck behind Colin Moran and Jung Ho Gung. And even now to this point, he's finally getting the opportunity, but it might be a little bit too late for that, for him to even really make an impact. And that's not counting the outfield, where he was stuck behind Gregory Polanco and Melky Cabrera. And at the time before they got injured, Lonnie Chisenhall was supposed to be there too. So you had more other, you had more guys on that depth chart that kind of got in the way. So there were always someone blocking him. There were always some players blocking him. But now he's getting that opportunity, and that's great. But are you really ready to call him a kid, or are you calling him just a guy that's kind of organizational depth at this point who's finally getting his chance?
Yeah, that's, I think that's what it comes down to for Osuna. We've seen him called up, sent back down so many times because if somebody's hurt, then they use him in that situation. But now that they got rid of Gung and Polanco's been out, they traded Dickerson, call up Osuna. They've been letting him play at third base, and you got to give him credit because
he's actually acquitted himself pretty
well. He wanted to learn third base because he said to Neil, I think Neil said this on his show, that Osuna was asked to start playing third base just to see if he could because they were trying to find a way to work his bat into the lineup. And credit to him, he learned how to play third base.
He's got a decent glove. He's got a capable arm. It makes a lot of sense, really, when you look at it. Now, going into next season, let's stick with Jose Osuna here for a second. If you're going into next season, are you okay with the possibility of a Jose Osuna, Colin Moran platoon at third base?
What about Cabrian Hayes?
Do we need to go there yet? Has he really kicked down the door?
Because he hasn't, no.
That's my thing. And I think there's a couple of people that share the same sentiment I do. I'm not going to get a guy from the minors just because I can.
And he's not ready yet.
I'm going to get a guy from the minors because he's really showing he doesn't need to be in the minors anymore. Like, if you remember when, you know, Austin Meadows was like, okay, this dude does not need to be in the minors anymore.
Right.
When Andrew McCutchen, it was like, okay, this dude does not need to be in the minors anymore. These guys were ready to go when the time came. So there really was no question as to whether or not they were ready. You can make the case that Gerrit Cole was showing people pretty strongly, okay, this dude doesn't need to be in the minors anymore. So you have to be kicking the door down, at least in my estimation. If you're using the reasoning of, well, how much worse can he be than the other guy? Do you really want to find that answer out?
No, because that could ruin him.
Right.
If he's not ready and you bring him up, that's why whenever people say, let's see what they've got, well, let's not call him up and let him get embarrassed. Let him be ready.
Yeah, because the question is, I guess, does what they have, did it translate in the minors already to be shown to be major league worthy? Because if it didn't, if they're just averaging the minors or slightly above, maybe they're not ready yet.
Right.
I mean, you have to be able to at least show that you can at least play consistently or dominate the level. And there are guys right now in AAA that aren't necessarily dominating the level. So, yeah, I'd love to see a Cabrian Hayes. I'd love to see a Jason Martin. I think it'd be great to see a Will Craig. But if you're not ready, why rush it and make things worse?
Right. So to answer your question, I'm okay with that platoon. I like Jose Osuna. Great bat. Like we talked about, does a great job at third base. And then if a righty's pitching, Colin Moran. There you go.
Who's a pretty much average guy. I'm going to say coming into the week, he had an even OPS 100 or OPS plus of 100 coming into the week. So he's about as average gets. So you have an average guy up against the right-hander with maybe a slightly above average guy against left-handers, but it's going to be a little bit fewer and further between. But, you know, when you look at the total crux of all of it, what were you really getting from your third base position before you went to this move? Because they had been one of the least producing third base teams in the league as far as, you know, number production goes. So that's one of those things that's probably a considerable upgrade just by changing one name and trotting those guys back out.
Right. I agree.
Now, to answer the question as far as who you look forward to seeing more intently the rest of the season, you know, we heard a lot of the same names, but for you, what's your answer?
It's got to be Brian Reynolds. He's trying to win the batting title. So, and he has been the most consistent hitter on this team this year. I mean, you would have said Josh Bell before the All-Star break, but
right,
that's completely fallen off right now. So, Brian Reynolds, young guy, makes you feel really good that you traded McCutchen for him because he's really panned out well for this Pirates baseball team. So, it's got to be Brian Reynolds.
I talked about this during the All-Star break. I did a small piece for KDK TV about the five things to pay attention to in the second half. One of them was specifically the rookies. I'd mentioned Kevin Newman. I'd mentioned Dario Agrizal. And then I put Brian Reynolds in a category all by himself. not because he was just a rookie, but because he was hitting that well, knowing that once he got the opportunity to play every day, he would eventually become eligible for the batting title. He's now knocking on that door, and he's up there on that list with your guy, Jeff McNeil, whom I know you love to watch, and he's actually a really good hitter. He's having a fantastic season. But Brian Reynolds is now knocking on that door. If there's anything that makes you feel even slightly good about seeing something happen this season, why not be the guy who's come in and pretty much lit the league on fire since he walked in the door?
Absolutely.
Not to mention the fact he got here by a complete mishap, because, once again, I'm going to keep bringing this up. If Eric Gonzalez and Starling Marte do not collide back in, what was that, May? Mm-hmm. Was that May or June? If that collision doesn't happen, we probably don't see Brian Reynolds at all.
Right. I agree.
It's kind of a strange, ironic problem. But this is what we're left with.
We might only see Brian Reynolds now because they traded Dickerson.
That's true also.
It might only be now.
Yeah, it might only be now because who knows.
Or when Polanco got hurt.
Because it might have been an Osuna or somebody, or maybe just Melky gets those.
And they tried Jason Martin first.
Right.
Sent him back down, went with Reynolds, and he just absolutely killed it from the get-go.
And here's the funny part. When they brought up Reynolds and Tucker at the same time, a lot of people were like, oh, man, Cole Tucker, it's a home run in this first game. It ends up being the difference in the game. I want to say, like, it was the eventual game winner.
Yes.
And everybody's like, man, Cole Tucker, he's taken off. I wouldn't have imagined that Brian Reynolds would still be here and Cole Tucker would be the one sent back down. But that's exactly what happened, because Reynolds came in, didn't do a lot to kind of jump off the page. He just came in, went to work, started hitting, and kept hitting the entire time, and literally has not stopped.
Yep.
And that's made the difference in all of it. So I agree with you. It's got to be Brian Reynolds as far as who you're paying attention to moving forward as we get to this last month and a half of the season. What we'll do right now is we will take a break. Got some sponsors to talk about. When we come back, we got to do what Greg and I always do when we're together talking about baseball. We got to do the world's worst Pirates preview. They got three games coming up this weekend against the Cardinals. We will preview that series. Plus, we will finish out with one last thing. You are listening to the Craig Wilson episode of the BuccoCast. Stick around.
Hey, everyone. This is Jason from the BuccoCast, and I want to take a moment to let you know that you can help our show in so many ways. Word of mouth is always the best, right? Tell a friend. Tell an enemy, tell a frenemy, tell any variation of what people are in these days, I have no idea. But tell them. You can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, anywhere you hear our show. But the best and most direct way that you can help us is by supporting our GoFundMe. That's right, we've joined the ranks of those asking for help. You can donate to us any amount, and the money will be used towards upgrading sound equipment and funding some live shows in the future. I'm going to put a link in the show notes right in your podcast app to scroll down and look at the notes. We'll have a link there. I'll also tweet it out. You can follow me at JRollisonPGH and follow the show at the BuccoCast, and I'll put a link there. If you want to, great. If not, no big. Hey, everyone. This is Jason from the BuccoCast. And before we get back into the podcast, I'd like to take a moment to remind you that we are brought to you by the Pittsburgh Fan. The Pittsburgh Fan is your one-stop shop for officially licensed MLB, NFL, NHL, and NCAA gear right across the street from PNC Park. They always have something unique, always have something kind of off the wall, and all the usual things you expect. Hats, shirts, jerseys, jerseys, anything else you can really think of. And they're right across the street, again, from PNC Park. So, if you're going to a game, why not leave just a little bit early? Go over and see what they got. Check them out online at thepittsburghfan.com. You can order from there as well. And follow them on Twitter at thepittfan. P-I-T-T fan.
Welcome back. Episode number 36 of the BuccoCast. Josh Taylor here with you. Greg Finley joining me, pinch hitting once again for Jason, who's not feeling so great, but Jason sending all of our best thoughts and wishes to him. Hopefully he's feeling better soon and back on his feet. But while we're here, Greg and I like to do something that we do every Sunday morning on the Sunday Morning Grind, whether it be baseball or even football. We do this all the time. We call it the world's worst Pirates preview. We also do the world's worst Steelers preview, but that's for another time. We still got about a couple more weeks to get that figured out. So we got a few more world's worst Pirates previews loaded up here in the queue waiting to go. So we got this one coming up here, three-game weekend series with the Cardinals at Busch Stadium, which probably seems like one of the worst places they could ever have to go at a particular time like this when you're 4-20 since the All-Star break. And as we look at last look, they trail the Brewers 5-1, and they could be 4-21 as they go into Busch Stadium. So it seems like a really, really bad place to have to go at this point. But here's how it shapes out at this point. Now, the pitching matchups going into the weekend for the Cardinals, Dakota Hudson, Adam Wainwright, Michael Wacha, it appears it'll be those three. At least that's what we expect. On the Pirates side, Chris Archer on Friday, Joe Musgrove Saturday, and Sunday is right now TBA. It could be Stephen Brault, considering the fact it would be 5 days since his last start on Tuesday, but I assume that Clint Hurdle will play that by ear. So with that said, we break down eight categories in the World's Worst Pirates preview. Not in a way you're probably used to hearing, but if you've listened a few times with me and Greg on the Sunday Morning Grind on 93.7 The Fan, you've probably become pretty accustomed to this game. So, Greg, let's start out with the guy the Pirates should worry about.
I got Colton Wong. I've had him a couple of times when the Pirates play the Cardinals, and it's because he's a Pirate killer.
Yes.
But as of late, he's 8-20 in his last seven. Post-All-Star break, Colton Wong is hitting .366 and a .904 OPS. He was hitting under 300 before the All-Star break.
Hmm.
So he's been on fire as of late, and that's why he's my Cardinal the Pirates to worry about.
I'm going to go with a guy that in these last two series that the Pirates have faced the Cardinals, that first of those two series, this was the guy that we managed to awaken like a sleeping giant by saying he had done pretty much next to nothing and had been playing like the worst first baseman in the division. And then he went absolutely insane and made us feel completely stupid for even invoking his name. Yes, I'm going with Paul Goldschmidt as the guy the Pirates should worry about. And here's why. Since July 14th, Paul Goldschmidt is hitting .284, but a .667 slugging percentage, a .996 OPS. That's just since the 14th of July. In those two series that we've talked about, the last two series against the Pirates, Goldschmidt, 8-25. That's a .400 clip with a double, five home runs, driven in 13 with five walks. So, yes, of those eight hits that he has against the Pirates in these previous two series, six of those eight hits are for extra bases. Five of them are home runs. He has absolutely just completely destroyed the ball and really made us look like idiots in the process. So we will not fall for this a second time, Paul Goldschmidt. We know you're coming, and we think you're the guy to worry about. Or at least I do.
So does that make you the advocate for Paul Goldschmidt?
Absolutely not.
Are you Paul Heyman?
I would happily accept that job, but I'm pretty sure he would not hire me because I'd find a way to screw that up because I would say something stupid and totally jinx him all over again.
If you haven't listened to the Sunday Morning Grind, we had an unreal compilation when we awoken the beast.
Oh my God.
Where we went back and played every home run call from the past two series that the Pirates and Cardinals played.
All five home runs we played.
And we went back to our comments about how Goldschmidt was the fifth best National League first baseman in the Central.
Why would we say that? Why?
We didn't even think about it either. We weren't like, we probably shouldn't have done that. We didn't even think about it.
We probably should not piss off Paul Goldschmidt. The only thing that's funnier about us saying that, him going off, is that he probably had no idea that we said it.
No.
So that's the irony of it all. He probably had no clue. It was just like, oh, great, it's the Pirates. And just takes off like a rocket.
It's like, man, I haven't been playing well lately. Maybe I should start. Oh, we're playing the Pirates.
Oh, wait, it's the worst pitching staff in the division and one of the worst in the league since the All-Star break. This times up perfectly.
This is the team that broke my hand when we were in the playoff hunt.
Oh, yeah, there's that. Yeah, he went absolutely insane.
Don't anger Paul Goldschmidt.
Please don't do that. Don't make the mistake that we did, and we can't help but keep apologizing for that. And if it happens again this weekend, that's probably our fault too. All right, so guy who the Cardinals should worry about on the Pirates side.
Well, we talked about it in that last segment when we talked about the young talent that we wanted to watch throughout the rest of this season. I got to go with Brian Reynolds. He's got a .303 batting average, .402 on base percentage, and a .545 slugging percentage on the road. At home, a little bit better with his batting average, a .412 with his on base percentage, and a .513 with his slugging. So slugging better on the road, better batting average, and better on base percentage at home, but not by much.
It's slightly. I mean, that's pretty consistent across the board.
Absolutely.
You got to look at that and say, if you're still questioning Brian Reynolds, the fact that he's hitting just about as good as he is on the road as he is at home, and probably slugging better on the road, that should come out and stick out at you a little bit, that fact that he's been that good and that consistent.
I agree, yeah. And in his last seven, two home runs and a .429 batting average, the guy just continues to swing the bat so well. And so that's why he's my guy the Cardinals should worry about.
And he's a switch hitter. He's doing it from both sides of the plate. That should not be lost on anybody either. That makes it even more fun. There's pretty much two guys that you can talk about since the All-Star break that opponents should worry about. You already mentioned the one, so I'll go ahead and mention the other one. Starling Marte, since the All-Star break, hitting .303, .340 on base percentage, slugging .636. He's got 30 hits, 16 of them are for extra bases. He's been one of the best hitting outfielders in baseball since they turned over the calendar, and he's just been really, really good. Let's go for the matchup for the Cardinals.
So the best matchup for the Cardinals, I have Andrew Miller versus Melky Cabrera. This was probably more of whenever Andrew Miller was with the Indians and Melky was with, insert, whatever American
Cleveland,
League team he played for.
Yeah, probably with Cleveland, you would think at least.
Well, Andrew Miller would have been with Cleveland.
Well, Andrew Miller would have been with Cleveland. He would have been maybe with the Yankees or
Kansas City.
Or with the White Sox. I want to say he was White Sox for a brief moment, too.
Yeah, so he's 3-for-25 versus Andrew Miller with 5 punch-outs.
Wow.
Hashtag get bases. Andrew Miller is like, no, no, no.
No, indeed. No bases. Hashtag no bases if you're Andrew Miller. You used my own hashtag against me. That was clever. Nicely done, sir. Matchup for the Cardinals, I'll go with Dexter Fowler against Joe Musgrove. Fowler has been pretty good. 11 times he's faced Musgrove, 5-for-11, a couple of doubles, a triple, a home run, and 2 walks in those 11 meetings between the two. So Dexter Fowler definitely gets my pick for the matchup that favors the Cardinals. What about the matchup for the Pirates, Greg?
Does it just seem like Dexter Fowler, since he moved to the National League Central, just kills the Pirates?
Pretty
when
much.
When he was on the Cubs, killed them, and now that he's on the Cardinals, it just seems like, man, Dexter Fowler's been in the league for so long because he was with the Rockies forever, and he's still, right. And he's just a pain. He could not have a good year, and he's still able to do what he does against the Pirates.
He's 33. I mean, this is a guy that, you know, you mentioned, as long as he's been in the game, he's 33. So, he has a lot left. It's not like he's completely burned out right now.
Right.
He can give you 2 or 3 really good more years of production, especially given the way that his career has kind of gone in that trajectory, and still be pretty good. And, of course, if you're an NL Central team, you don't want to hear that because it's really bad.
Can he go to a new team?
Yeah, like Dexter Fowler, seriously, like, could you just not stay in the Central for so long?
Can you just go to, like, Oakland or something?
Right. And I think he'd do great in Oakland. I think they'd love him out there. You know, Billy Bean, he loves guys like Dexter Fowler. Okay, the matchup for the Pirates, who you got?
I got Musgrove versus DeJong. Paul DeJong, 1-for-12 versus Musgrove with 3 strikeouts. You definitely need to keep Paul DeJong's bat quiet when you're playing the Cardinals.
I think that's fair because it looks like there's 2 guys that the Pirates will have starting this weekend that keep Paul DeJong's bat quiet. The other one's Chris Archer. DeJong against Archer is 1-for-11 with 5 strikeouts and 14 plate appearances. So it looks like Musgrove and Archer both have success against DeJong, and you hope they can keep that going, plus some of those other guys in that lineup being all cardinally and stuff.
It's a thing. Look it up.
Yeah, it's a thing. We always talk about the Cardinals being all cardinally, and they usually do that when it comes to the Pirates. Let's go to the Cardinal no one's talking about.
The Cardinal nobody's talking about for me is Tommy Edman, who was a guy that they called up whenever Carpenter got hurt. Started off pretty hot, but he has cooled down a ton, hitting just .136. In the month of August.
Yeah, and he was expected to really take over and you know, at least bring some kind of stability to that third base spot. Plus, he can play a little bit of short. He can play a couple different infield positions. So, I mean, granted, he's 24 years old. He's really getting his first taste of the big leagues. But he can look a little bit more like you saw at the beginning. Maybe he becomes a guy that's a little bit more reliable for them down the road. I'm going to go with Jose Martinez as the Cardinal no one's talking about. Since the All-Star break, Martinez hitting .209. With a .328 slugging percentage. And this is a dude who's huge. He's 6'6", 215. He's got a big, strong bat, but he has not really been that guy in the second half of the season. So Jose Martinez is my Cardinal no one's talking about. What about the Pirate no one's talking about, Greg?
So originally I had Francisco Liriano, but I'm going to change it to Josh Bell. He's been a giant disappointment since the All-Star break. I don't know what's going on with him, but the way that he was tearing it up at the beginning of this year, first half of this year, everybody that says it's the home run derby, it's not the home run derby.
No, he was falling off before the derby.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. It's not like this is something we're just saying to be, you know, against the group here, or to be against the mob. Go back and look it up. Go look at what he was doing at the end of June going into July. He had already started to slow down in those couple weeks before the All-Star break. It was not the home run derby. I thought someone else, I can't remember who it was right now, but they put in a great perspective. He took, what, maybe 25, 30 swings in the home run derby?
And they weren't hard.
Yeah, I have a hard time believing it was that, you know, small number of swings that made the difference.
Here it is. 289 in April, 390 in May, 208 in June, 218 in July.
There you go.
154 now in August. Pre-All-Star break was hitting 302. Post-All-Star, he's hitting 176.
Yeah, but we talked about that at the time when he was just supernova in May, and you sit there going, there's no way he can sustain that for a total season, right? There's no way he can keep that going. Because going into the All-Star break, he was on pace to have only, I think it was only the third season ever with 100 or more extra base hits. And the only two guys that have done it were Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, and each of those guys only did it once.
Right.
So that's what we were looking at. That's how good Josh Bell was at one point before the All-Star break. Maybe he had just been that good, and things needed to kind of even out a little bit to normalize. Maybe that's what it was.
It just makes me wonder what's been going on, though, because it's disappointing. He was really a fun story for this team, and it just seemed like every time you turn the game on, like, why are they pitching to Josh Bell? This is not a guy you should pitch to.
Yeah.
But now it's just like, man, Josh Bell can't hit anything right now. So I don't know what it is, but a lot has changed for him since, like what we talked about, since going into July. June, he cooled off a ton, but July and August, it just has not been his time.
And I think part of it, really, if you think about back to last season, when he was really tapering off in such a disappointing year last year. I think he had, 12 home runs last season?
Mm-hmm.
But Clint Hurdle said he sat down with Josh Bell and told him, look, here's the scouting report on you. Don't throw anything near the plate because he'll swing at anything. I think he has times when he reverts to that habit because he had so much success hitting the ball so well, hitting breaking pitches so well, which Jason, of course, pointed out earlier in the season during the podcast. He had become so good at hitting breaking stuff and, you know, pretty good at hitting fastballs when he actually swung at them, because he actually hadn't swung at fastballs as much as he did at breaking pitches and just completely destroying him. And I think the league started to readjust to it and says, hey, let's not give him as much of an easy pitch to hit. And maybe there's a little bit extra pressure there. You want to keep that run going. Yeah, I can't really speak for what's going on in his head. You can only speculate at this point. But there was a period where they weren't giving him great stuff to hit, and he wasn't doing a lot with it. So obviously, there's going to be some back and forth here. Could things still turn back around in August?
Of course,
since he's being
could.
Sat down for a couple games, and that's another great reason why he's the Pirate no one's talking about, because he's getting a couple days off. Clint Hurdle's going to let him unplug. So could that still come about when this weekend comes around? Yeah, sure. I mean, it's what, there's 6 weeks left in the season? So maybe things come around and he ends on a good note. Remember last season, as lost of a season as it felt like for him, he ended the season in September on a pretty good note. So hopefully you can see that second thing, or that same thing happen a second time.
Yeah, and that's a good point by you. He definitely has chased a lot of breaking balls in the dirt, which he did not do at the beginning of this year. So you could be right. I would not surprise me if you're right, but what I'm saying is pitchers have figured it out because of how well that he was killing them, especially the teams in the National League Central, which
yes.
They played a lot of them these last couple of weeks.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, they did their homework.
I would say that, and I would not be surprised if last year, what they saw from last year had a part in some of it, and saying, look, this is what you were doing when you were successful against them last year. Let's try that again. Or, you know, here's what happens when he struggles. And you have that benefit now of not just having scouts and scouting reports. You have video. You have advanced numbers. You have baseball savant. You have all these metrics that can show you everything pretty much detail by detail as to how things look when things are going great and how things look when things are going bad. How about the
Who's yours?
My Pirate no one's talking about. And this is an interesting choice. You pick Josh Bell because he hasn't played well. I'm going with a guy who hasn't played much at all. Felipe Vasquez. Is he still in this bullpen? Because we haven't seen him very much. They've played 24 games since the All-Star break. Felipe Vasquez has pitched in 6 of them. That's it. And 2 in the last 2 weeks. Where is Felipe Vasquez? Now, I understand your team's been 4-20, so you haven't had many opportunities for saves. But he's still one of the best left-handed relievers in the game. As far as left-handers go, it's what, him and Josh Hader?
Yep.
Why are you not pitching this guy? Even if you don't need him for a save opportunity, maybe one of those days where the bullpen blows it late, Maybe you win that game if you go to Felipe Vasquez instead of pitching to a statistic and being so concerned about getting the save opportunity as opposed to, hey, let's get this guy in here to keep us in this game and maybe win it later.
Yep.
And that's considering the fact that we just came off of a trade deadline where someone wanted him. Now, granted, yeah, they didn't give you what you wanted, but you could have moved that guy if you weren't going to do anything with him. So you kept him, and now you don't use him.
And you're not using him.
It makes no sense. It makes no sense. So my pirate, no one's talking about Felipe Vasquez. A random stat. We started adding this because it was something that we kind of came up with just on a whim with a random stat. Here's a good random stat. Adam Wainwright scheduled to face the Pirates on Saturday. Adam Wainwright has a 3.60 ERA lifetime in the month of August. That is actually the second highest of any month in his entire career. In May, his ERA is 3.62. So this is Adam Wainwright's second worst month historically in his career, at least according to ERA is concerned. So there's that.
He's not the same guy that he used to be.
Oh, no.
But, you know, age and injuries have really caught up to him.
And I'd say it's more age than the injuries kind of came after the fact. But if you think back, what was that, maybe 8 or 9 years ago? Like Adam Wainwright, when he wasn't even in the rotation yet, he was coming out of the bullpen during that playoff run, and he's just bending guys' knees with that curveball. You probably remember this as much as anybody, how he finished off the Mets in that playoff run.
Why are you doing this to me?
I got to point it out, man. He was just good. I'm trying to think back who it was. I know Carlos Beltran was one of those guys. And there were a couple other Mets that he just completely embarrassed with that curveball. Like,
yep.
Early in his career, that curveball was just humming. And then the rest of the repertoire came around with it, and he just started to take off as a starter, and he's been really, really good. Although he will admit that, you know, he loves PNC Park, but his ERA is not that great there, and he wants it to come down. I thought that was a really cool tweet from Adam Wainwright. Prediction for this weekend series.
I got the Cardinals taking 2 out of 3.
So do I. The only thing that might change my mind, if I knew who the third starter was, maybe I'd feel differently. But the fact that they have a guy like Wainwright going against this team, the fact that they're going to be in St. Louis, the fact that most of these guys are not hitting, and the two guys that are starting this weekend, Archer, his arrow's probably pointing up. Musgroves, kind of goes from start to start. One start it's pointing up, the next start it's pointing down. It's really kind of hard to decipher which Joe Musgrove you're going to get. So it's hard for me to look at it only knowing two of the three pitchers and knowing that one of them has not been fairly consistent, even though the other one is starting to become more consistent, maybe a year late or so, but whatever. It's still hard to gauge in this particular context.
For how bad Walker's been this year, I think they win Sunday.
Really?
Yes.
Fair enough.
If it's Brault, or if it's insert name here, Michael Walk has been terrible for the Cardinals.
I think that's fair. Now, if you wanted to tell me that you knew for a certainty Brault was starting Sunday, maybe I can be tipped towards the Pirates winning 2 out of 3, in which case that would be their first series win since the All-Star break. But I'm not ready to go there yet.
Me either.
Nope, we're not doing that. That is the World's Worst Pirates preview. Pirates and Cardinals coming up this weekend in St. Louis. We are near the end of episode 36 of the BuccoCast. Before we get to one last thing, I want to remind everybody, you can find this podcast anywhere. Podcasts are downloaded. iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, iHeartRadio, and this is really cool. This is something we just discovered here just this week. The BuccoCast, now available on the radio.com app, which is cool.
That's awesome.
Which is cool for me, being a guy who hosts a show that can already be heard on the radio.com app. So you can hear Greg and I on the Sunday Morning Grind on the radio.com app, and you can listen to this podcast on the radio.com app. So we have now expanded into yet another place to find the BuccoCast. It's just really great news. And when we say it's everywhere fine podcasts are downloaded, we do mean everywhere. So by all means, check it out. With that said, one last thing. Greg, have at it.
Okay. I have two quick things. Number one, Jordan Lyles is 2-0 since the Pirates traded him.
Oops.
Their pitching staff has been such a mess, and Jordan Lyles beat them, and he beat the Athletics. Who saw that coming? I think we did. Whenever he got traded, we're like, you know what? He'll probably figure it out in Milwaukee, because that's what he did last year.
Yep. And that's a topic I won't want to bring up around Jason, because he was kind of the Jordan Lyles guy coming into the season. So maybe it's good that he's not doing this show. So that way, but then again, he's going to hear it later. So sorry, Jason. But,
so
yeah,
so that. So there's that. And then quickly, the New York Mets, what a story. For how bad they were making radio hosts throw things. They got... We played Zach Gelb on our show.
We did.
He was getting so mad whenever they did stock up, stock down, and said stock down on the New York Mets. And Francesa.
Mike Francesa just destroyed the Mets.
Which was just absolutely hilarious.
Andrew Filippone, our colleague at 93.7 The Fan, pretty much wanted Mickey Callaway fired.
He wanted to leave his fanhood.
He was ready to denounce his fanhood as a Mets fan.
And they become buyers at the trade deadline. And everyone was like, okay, what's going on here? They get Stroman, and they turn the whole season around.
Stroman, Thorne, DeGrom doesn't feel fair.
It's not.
That does not feel fair at all.
So, quickly, again, the way that the Mets have turned this whole thing around, they were the biggest joke in baseball.
A month ago, these two teams, between the Pirates and the Mets, were in completely different positions.
Yes.
It's insane.
And I kept telling people, it's like, man, my teams can never win at the same time. The Pirates win, the Mets lose. The Pirates go on a really hot streak, the Mets just keep losing. Now, the Mets just keep winning. They've won six in a row now since we're recording this. And the Pirates have lost 20 games since the All-Star break.
My God.
What is happening? Why are the Mets not the biggest joke anymore? Have they figured it out, or are they going to break my heart when we get closer to the playoffs?
Sports are weird, Greg. Sports are weird.
So that's my one last thing.
Here's what I'll tell you for one last thing. And I can't stress this enough. There needs to be an understanding of what this team really has in terms of talent. Because if you're going off of what we've seen this season, there's only a couple things that are really bright spots. Brian Reynolds, yes. Kevin Newman to a degree, yes. Josh Bell, to a degree, yes, especially in the first half of the season. These were things you looked at and said, okay, these are things that have gone great. But it's worth pointing out again, a couple of those things are largely related to something that should have never happened. Because if that doesn't happen, maybe we don't see Newman when we do. Maybe we don't see Reynolds when we do. Maybe we're still talking about Starling Marte never being hurt, Eric Gonzalez still being this team shortstop, and we probably never see what Kevin Newman brings to the table. So you can make the case that the brightest spots of the season, two of them, were things that weren't supposed to happen because they were unexpected. And the third thing in Josh Bell, we didn't see coming a mile away. That's a bad sign. When the best things that are happening to your team in a season are either A, things that no one in any time zone or Marvel Cinematic Universe dimension ever anticipated, or things that should not have happened because of something bad happening, if those are the things you're hanging your hat on, things are not good. That's a problem.
The only thing that has been a guarantee, I'd say, is that Vasquez is still a dominant closer.
That's it. That's the one thing that's been consistent from start to finish. The rest of it has either been unexpected, not supposed to happen, or probably the silver lining from disaster happening. And that's pretty much been it. And if you're looking at it that way and understanding that this is what's happening right now, and you're looking in the next year trying to find something that gives you hope, what else is there? I understand it. When people, and normally when people tell me, oh, I'm done with this team, I'm throwing my hands up, I'm like, all right, yeah, you'll be back tomorrow. I just kind of, yeah, okay. You waited till now to be done? You weren't done 5 years ago? Okay, fine. All right, you're done again. Okay, fine. So I hear that a lot, and I'm like, all right. But even me personally, I find myself wondering what comes back next year with this group that makes you feel any better about it. What comes back as far as the front office? What comes back as far as the coaching staff? Is there any change that can be made between now and next Easter that can make you feel better about this team in 2020? And if there is one, by all means, let me know. Give me a shout at Josh Taylor HD or give us a shout at the BuckoCast on Twitter. Because if you can find something that can be done between now and maybe 6 months from now, and for the love of God, please do not tell me about the owner selling the team, because we all know that's not happening. So just stop. Stop. Like, let's deal in the realm of realistic here. Is there one thing that can happen that can make you feel better about what's happening right now with this team? Because we already talked about it. The guy who's supposed to be their best starter, we're not going to see him till at least midseason next year. The guy who was supposed to come in and be the supplement, he's getting better, but how much can you hang your hat on him right now? So that's the one thing just from the pitching standpoint. And that's not counting what you're seeing offensively.
And will they even keep Archer?
And will they
even
keep
Archer? We don't even know that part.
There are still so many questions. This is why we're talking about whether or not the pitching coach is a scapegoat or who else could be a scapegoat right now that gets blamed for this. Because there are so many variables that are so unknown that you really can't hang your hat on. And as a baseball fan, it should concern you a bit. So as we go into the end of this season, looking into next year, you wonder what else can happen that can change your mind. Anything other than maybe more crazy things happening and good things happening in spite of them. Like with Brian Reynolds and Kevin Newman getting opportunities and even slightly Cole Tucker. That might be it, because right now it's going to take something chaotic to maybe spur something else happening that's worth looking forward to. Other than that, I can't think of much.
They would have to move somebody or make a big signing in free agency, which they don't do that.
They don't do that. And
so what are we supposed to be excited about?
It's going to take some time. It's going to take some time, and there's going to have to be – I shouldn't say there's going to have to be, but there needs to be. There needs to be a different view of the evaluation of this team. There needs to be a difference in how they view what this team is and really what they're setting out to do, because right now they're not meeting that goal.
They need an identity.
Yes.
And they don't have one.
Yes.
Huntington comes on his radio show and says that he's expecting Vasquez to be the closer next year in playoff games. So already he is looking ahead to next year, saying next year is the year. We are making the playoffs. What are you going to do that's going to make me as a fan believe that this team's a contender?
I think you nailed it with the identity thing. Because think about it. Go back four or five years ago. Go back 6 years ago to 2013. This was a team that actually had an identity. Their identity was they had some young, exciting players. Andrew McCutchen, of course, was a young, exciting guy. Neil Walker was a guy who might not have been as exciting, but we knew the entire area was behind because, you know, his birth certificate had Allegheny County on it, so there's that.
Alvarez.
Pedro Alvarez was still a young, budding slugger who at one point was tied for the league lead in home runs with 36 and won a silver slugger. So there was a lot of excitement there. Plus, there was a pitching staff that had been the best there had been in 20 years. So you had that. You had Gerrit Cole. You had A.J. Burnett. You had Francisco Liriano. Later on, you had Edinson Volquez. You had guys in that pitching staff, plus in the bullpen, Jason Grilly, Mark Melancon, Jarrett Hughes.
Tony Watson.
You had a bullpen that was as good and as effective as the starting rotation was. And they were a team that at least appeared to be, if not in step with everybody else, maybe even somewhat ahead of the curve as far as studying some things and having some kind of edge of knowledge or something analytically. I don't even know where they are there now, because they seem so far behind everybody else, even in that aspect. That's a great way to put it. What is this team's identity? Who are they? Hopefully we find out in the next couple months, or maybe in the next half of a year before opening day in 2020.
Boy, we got deep at the end of that.
We did, man. We waxed philosophical. I don't think we've ever done that before, at least not on this level.
That's what happens when your team goes 4-20. Yeah, they make you mad.
That's what happens when your team goes 4-20 and you're on the episode of your podcast that resembles Craig Wilson. That's exactly what happens. Episode number 36 of the BuckoCast. Thanks again, everybody, for listening. And if you're tuning in, once again, you can find this podcast iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio, radio.com app. That is the newest one. You can find us just about everywhere. Follow us on Twitter, Jason at JRollisonPGH, yours truly, Josh Taylor HD. Follow the podcast at The BuckoCast. Greg, where can they find you?
At the GFin.
If you're looking for Greg, just find like maybe one out of four tweets from me. It's probably something about World's Worst Pirates preview or wrestling related. That's usually how it works with the two of us.
Or is this a thing?
Or is this a thing? That happens a lot too. One of those three or four categories. In the meantime, that's it for us. We'll see you next week.